Lucian, thank you very much for the invitation, and to you and Matthew for all the PI staff for organising such a splendid occasion. Lucian was joking that he's scared of you, indeed very scared, and I haven't seen the applications which he and Matt Leifer and others have, but I am very, very scared, partly because, as you may know, I'm actually a philosopher of physics, I'm not a physicist, so I am a bit of a warm-up gig, as they say, in the popcorn industry for the other lecturers. That said, my plan will be to talk first about the measurement problem and then about quantum non-locality. And it may be that it's all done by 10:15, because we'll fire up on our morning coffee. And I would appreciate interruptions, but also silent hand signals to speed up or slow down. Because I haven't seen the applications, and it may be that actually the expertise is quite diverse between different people. In any case, I always like to joke that apparently Enrico Fermi had, you know, Freud had a pleasure principle, but so did Enrico Fermi, and apparently he said, never underestimate the pleasure that an audience takes in hearing what it already understands. And that's certainly true in technical matters. So there will be quite a bit of warming up your brain about this morning, I suspect. So in any case, let me begin by saying that I think there are, in effect, four historical periods in quantum foundations, which are always in the back of my mind as I talk through these matters. There are the titanic struggles of the founding fathers, of whom I stole a couple of photos. Here's a cup of coffee between Bohr and Heisenberg. And speaking of titanic struggles, or between founding fathers, this is the front of the Zurek and Wheeler collection. It's Einstein and Bohr, very murky. And it's not just my bad reprographics, actually. It's a murky photo, rather black photo. But you'll know that Einstein and Bohr were at loggerheads, and that it eventuated in the EPR argument of 1935, and Bohr's reply to that, which I'll come on to as part of my discussion of quantum non-locality. After that initial period, of course, between Bohr was regarded as winning, and the Second World War came, and there was a period of consolidation, pragmatism, and practical exploitation of quantum theory, partly maintained by the large influence of Bohr, who died in, I think, 62. And then in the
So you say there was a period of practical application on quantum mechanics. Would you say it's fair to say that these applications are really not concerned with the philosophical issues of quantum mechanics, which are introduced in physics, like inherent probabilities? Because I always have a feeling that what you do is you just solve for energy levels of some particular practical applications.
Okay, so I would agree with the last.
Yes.
I think it's true that if you think just historically, what was the main burden of intellectual effort by the quantum physics community between even 1930, but certainly 1940 onwards through to the mid 60s. The vast majority of that effort was theoretical and experimental development of quantum physics. And as you might well be right, you know, energy levels paramount, interpretations of probability certainly minute, nobody thought about them. People would talk about probabilities, but they didn't concern themselves with these foundation issues at all. This is what I was trying to say. Okay. Broadly speaking, of course, there were some authors like Henry Morgenau who was concerned with foundations all through this period. But in any case, that would be my second phase, sweep it under the rug phase, sweep it under the carpet. In the 60s, as all of you will know, there was, in a way, three main developments. Quantum logic on the one hand, Bell's theorem on the other hand, and on the third hand, so to speak, the Cochran-Specker theorem. So there was actually a renaissance in foundational studies in the 60s. And that propagated through to the 1980s, and in effect, in my field, philosophy led to the invention or arising of a subfield of philosophy of science called the philosophy of physics. And then the fourth period would be from 1990, or if you like, mid-80s onwards, the burgeoning quantum information and quantum computation community, which is obviously involved in foundational issues. Though obviously others will speak much more about that. So what I will discuss is actually, in effect, the third period, the 60s through to the 80s. Okay, so in this first part then about measurement, let's begin by stating the measurement problem, which you again, as I say, probably familiar with. I think the cleanest way to state it is to state an orthodox interpretation of a minimal kind and say why it has a problem. And that will then lead to a discussion of possibilities. So what the way I'd like to frame the next half hour is I'm going to give you a formalism-free statement of the measurement problem and the possibilities for answering it. On the slides, there'll be no formalism. Of course, there may be spontaneous questions and go into some of the details of how to answer the measurement problem as we go along. But if I get to the end of this initial statement, I'll then do the kind of lecture standard gambit of telling it all over again to you in more detail. So I want to state the measurement problem in a formalism-free way, talk about the strategies for replying to it, and then go back over the details again. And when I go back over the details, I really want to do two main things. One is to talk about the projection postulate, and to talk in that connection about the formalism of density matrices or mixtures, which many of you will have come across. But I want to stress in particular a distinction which d'Espagnat focused very well and gave a name to, a distinction between two kinds of mixture, which he called proper and improper. And this will be important for understanding why there is a measurement problem. There's a certain kind of formal mathematical thing you can do that suggests that the measurement problem is solved within orthodox quantum theory. And d'Espagnat put his finger on the point that this idea doesn't really work because it only delivers you an improper mixture. Okay. So I want to emphasize that. And then actually I'm hoping in the kind of last sector to talk about decoherence and the Everett interpretation. So to try and give some structure to between now and we stop at 10:15, I think, don't we? Yeah. So in effect, I've said that we've had the preamble where I've said there are four historical periods. And that, in fact, between now and 11:30, it's the third period, which is, so to speak, 1960s to 1980s that I'm going to discuss. And as regards measurement, I'm going to bore you to death with a formalism-free survey. Right? Formalism-free survey of the basic problem. The measurement problem, right? And then, that's the first thing I'll do. Then I want to talk about mixtures and density matrices. And I'm going to emphasize that mixtures can be proper or improper using the d'Espagnat terminology. And finally, I'd like to talk a bit about decoherence and Everett, or many worlds. So that's what I'd like to do. At this point, any questions or indeed objections? No? Okay. Thanks. So what is this minimal orthodox treatment of quantum theory, which I say faces a measurement problem? Okay. I said there was such a thing. Well, I'm going to take it then that there's what you might call, is sometimes called the minimal instrumental interpretation. It says, concerning the best known kind of quantum state, the vector state, never mind mixtures and density matrices, imagine you've never heard of them, if you have already heard of them. Just concerning vector states, yes, a vector state, like a pure state, represented by a wave function or a Dirac ket. Orthodoxy says, what is the interpretation of this state? That it is a prescription of probability distributions for the results of measurement. And this is given by the Born rule. And as you all know, in fact, although first stated for position by Born in 1926, it was very soon realized that this applied to other observables with the transformation theory of Dirac and others. And it's actually really the geometry of Hilbert space. The probability for a given eigenvalue is to be the squared length of the projection of the vector state into the corresponding eigenspace. So that's the orthodox interpretation, or minimal instrumentalist interpretation, with the gloss that the probability distribution is actually the events for it. It is our results of measurement. And if you ask, well, under what circumstances does the quantum system, typically a microscopic system, microphysical system, under what circumstances does it have a value for a physical quantity, the minimal instrumentalist, or as I'll call it, orthodox interpretation says, it has a value if and only if the vector state is an eigenstate for the quantity concerned, and then the value is the eigenvalue. Okay? So that's orthodoxy. That last remark is sometimes called, especially in the more philosophy literature, the eigenvalue-eigenstate link. So the idea is you have a value only when you're in an eigenstate. And coming from philosophy, philosophers would say two things when they hear this statement of the orthodox interpretation. First of all, the first thing they'd say is something that I think anybody would say if they thought about it for a minute, that it is very odd to have a physical theory whose fundamental interpretative construal of its formalism is in terms of measurement results rather than the values of quantities. Measurement apparatuses are vastly larger than the microsystem you're concerned with. It's a very curious business to have the interpretation of the state of the microsystem being fundamentally explicated in terms of results of the pointer readings on very large apparatus. But the second comment is about the eigenvalue eigenstate link, which namely having a value means having it by being in an eigenstate, which means, according to the first part, having it with probability one. It is very odd to have the identification of a fact, namely the value of energy is blah, with that fact having probability one. You know, philosophers, of course, debate the nature of probability in many ways over the decades, centuries, I should say, since, you know, the 17th century. But in general, it is normal to allow that there can be facts which are not probability one. But clearly, the eigenvalue eigenstate link is having that. Okay, so that's the orthodox interpretation.
Hang on just a second. You said you can have a fact that's not a probability one. What does that mean? If it's a fact, it's a fact, right? I mean,
Thank you for that. It's very, I'll try to answer. But of course, as a lecturer, my main strategy will be to try to get you to fight amongst yourselves so that I can just receive it to the back.
Well, I just wanted to clarify what I meant by that, because I understood. I wasn't arguing against
you. Sure. No, I appreciate that. I respect that. So, I'm glad you mentioned it, because there's always a kind of, at least at this level of generality that my couple of hours will be about, there is going to be a rather vague cloud of philosophy issues round the corner from anything I say, if not out loud, what I think. And probability, obviously, there are three main traditional interpretations of it. One would be to say that it's the degree of belief of an agent, like when you go bet on a horse race. Another would be to say that it's a physical tendency, often called propensity, in the, so it's a totally objective thing about the world. And the third thing, which goes back to Laplace and has modern representatives in a great philosopher, Rudolf Carnap, is to say, it's called the logical interpretation, which is roughly, it's not subjective, it's objective, it's, you can be right or wrong about it, but it's not really a physical matter. It's, in effect, a kind of selection, for example, by reasons of symmetry, of one probability distribution being the correct one rather than another. Now, what most people would say in all... Sorry, go on.
I was just asking, like, can you give me an example of a fact that does not have probability one? Yeah. Does to me, yeah. Fact means it is, and therefore,
right.
The probability
right.
of it being
right.
is one.
Right,
so
sure, yeah.
Is there a counterexample to that, or did I misunderstand what you said?
Okay, I think I have two. I'll give you two. One might be more contentious than the other.
Okay.
First one, I'm going to take the subjective subjective interpretation of probability. So you could actually think it's one-third likely that the horse won, the horse called, I don't know, Bellerophon, won in yesterday's race. So, but in fact, Bellerophon did win, but your degree of belief is one-third. So there's a fact, but the associated probability is a third. Now, you might say, hang on, I'm not interested in subjective probabilities about past events. I mean, they either happened or they didn't, and surely if they happened, then there's probability one. In which case, I would move to my second example, and I would like to first of all try and make a bit of peace with you. It is conventional in philosophy of probability to say that the propositions about the past, which are in fact true, have a physical probability one. Okay. And that is conventional because it has you can prove it in certain kinds of framework for how should physical probabilities evolve over time, and how should physical probabilities evolve over time relate to how degrees of belief change over time. So philosophers have got these little mini proofs that have a little corollary of true propositions about the past have probability one. But what about the future? Now here, since the time of Aristotle and before, philosophers have debated whether or not there are actual facts about the future. And after a long struggle, I have to admit that as a graduate student in philosophy, I came around to the view that there are actual facts about the future, it's just that we don't happen to know them. So I am what is called a block universe enthusiast, right? So space-time models in space-time theory, relativity theory, are, you know, mother's milk to me. I love that picture of the world as laid out throughout all time as well as throughout all space. Now, in that vision, it's reasonable to say, I think, that nevertheless the world could be indeterministic and there could be degrees of tendency or propensity for various possible futures. And on that view, then, there could be a fact, you know, Butterfield will in fact have, as it might be, two grandchildren.
What is that?
Neither of my children has kids, so, you know, there's just some fact, it's unknown, but actually it's a stochastic process, marrying and having kids, and maybe there are physical probabilities governing conception and whatnot, and it's actually, you know, chance one-tenth that Butterfield has three grandchildren, but you know, by roughly 2050, it will be known one way or the other.
All right, I guess
so. That's my
guess. It's just a definition thing, because I mean,
I really don't understand what you meant by fact in that sentence, but I don't think we should go.
Okay, so by fact, I would mean true proposition. Proposition means statement about the world. Okay, yeah, so thank you. And of course, event in the sense of probability theory, of course, we take conjunctions and negations of events and disjunctions of events. You know, you might put it in set theoretic notation instead. But events, which are the arguments of probability functions, have this and not or structure to them. And of course, logicians say propositions do. So event for probabilists is like fact. Or a true event, event that actually occurred for a probabilist, would be like fact in the mouth of a philosopher.
Okay.
Thanks. Thank you for that. Okay, gentleman at the back, and then you, sir.
Yeah. I was just thinking you could take your first example and move the horse outside of your lifetime, and then it would be, I mean, you could argue that it's a fact, even though you physically can't know for sure.
Yeah. Indeed, being a block universe enthusiast, I would want to do that. Yeah. So thank you. Sorry, so you had one.
Yeah, real quick. Actually, I was wondering if I could back up for just a second and ask you to restate the eigenvalue, eigenstate link interest in English just one time as clear as possible.
Right.
I don't mean that.
It's the measured system. Okay, so the microsystem. Oh, so are these mobile?
The ones above.
The ones above. Okay, good. Oh, and it's a three-layer thing. That's great. It's very clear. It's very clear. No, it's most impressive. Anyway, so stick here for a moment. What is the statement? Suppose the thing is in an eigenstate. Suppose the system is in a state V, which is an eigenstate for eigenvalue V of a certain quantity, then the measured system, this system, has got the value V for that quantity. And otherwise it doesn't. That's the measure. Yes. So it's called the logical interpretation of probability traditionally. And it's associated with Laplace, and it got beaten up badly in the 20th century, early 20th century, with the rise of the developed subjectivist view of people like Frank Ramsey, Cambridge philosopher, De Finetti in Italy. And then it was resuscitated by Carnap, and indeed, I would say that it was resuscitated by statistical physicist James. And what is the view? Well, they might call it objective Bayesianism now, but the old traditional philosophy name for it is logical interpretation. And, you know, the view about, I think perhaps the best way to say it is it does merge into the propensity or physical probability view, but the physical probability view tends to go along with the idea that there is indeterminism, and that to make sense of physical probabilities that are not zero or one, you need to have an indeterministic physical setup, so that the non-one, non-zero probabilities are tendencies, and there are genuine alternatives for the future evolution. Therefore, the physical probability or propensity tradition is much involved in the evolution of physical chances over time. The logical interpretation of Laplace and Carnap is compatible with determinism and isn't much involved in how the probabilities change over time. And it tends to say, when challenged, oh, so what is this objective probability? They have some argument that considerations of symmetry dictate one distribution as correct. Now, I'm actually, to be honest, no fan of this view. But the idea was, for example, in Laplace, that the symmetries of a die make it rational uniquely rational to assign probability of 6 to each outcome. And more generally, there was a thing called the principle of indifference, which I don't know quite who invented this, but the idea was that if there is an equality of ignorance about the different alternatives, then it is uniquely rational to assign equal probabilities. And of course, this does tend to it depends upon how you, as they say, coordinatize your probability space. If I'm throwing a dart at the 0, 1 interval, then you can imagine saying, well, I'm uniformly ignorant as to the subintervals in which it might land, so I should assign a uniform probability density equal to 1, whose integral then gives 1 for the entire 0, 1 interval. But this can be criticized by saying, what about, instead of parameterizing it with x, parameterize it with x squared. You're equally uniformly ignorant for the various subintervals of the values of x squared in which it might lie. So on changing how I happen to coordinatize my probability space, x versus x squared, the principle of indifference will give me different verdicts. But in any case, these monumental figures of Bass, Carnap, James, of course, have replies to little old me, but that is my view about it. That it doesn't really work, actually, but that's, that helps a bit. How you think of it? No, okay, so, well, that's helpful. Yes, I didn't say that, and I should have, and I think the answer lies in my phrase uniquely rational. Laplace, Carnap, James don't just say there is this objective probability, but they also say that it controls what we should believe. We ought to set our degrees of, they admit that people have degrees of belief, and that science and everyday life depend upon people's degrees of belief. And they're saying the difference from traditional subjectivism or Bayesianism is it's uniquely rational to believe this. There isn't that sort of freedom that the traditional Bayesian allows. So that's all right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Sorry, just about the eigenvalue eigenstate thinking game. Does it mean that you imply you can measure the state so that you can be sure that it's already in an eigenstate, or measurement is not involved in the statement?
It's not involved in the statement. Sorry, I think I did use the phrase the measured system has the value if and only if in an eigenstate, but I should have said a quantum system, a microsystem. A system to which you give a quantum state, a system which has a quantum state, has a value for a quantity if and only if it is in an eigenstate. Sorry. It doesn't actually involve invoking the change as occurring to the system. Okay. Yeah.
But then, so how do you put that as so? Do you want to invoke the collapse of wave function for that, or just you take it for granted that it's possible to address other states?
Yeah, I took it for granted. Yeah. I mean, my technician supplies me with a bead, every element of which is in this. I, at least on a Monday, or at least until 20 minutes from now.
It was really okay. I mean, you would need to do a measurement first, checking out that it's in the eigenstate.
Sure.
Because even if the technician gives you a beam, there's a galaxy far away, which has a gravitational field, and that influences the beam, and it's time seconds later, can't do any more in your eigenstate.
Right. So I am very much a philosopher standing above the practicalities, and I'm just taking it for granted. And I'm just trying to assert what my theory says. If it is in fact in this thing, then it has a value. If it's not in this, then it doesn't have a value. So.
But then again, the existence of such states becomes a problem for experimental physics, yes.
The existence.
I don't know this for sure, for purely philosophical reasons. Do I?
Our knowing that there are such states or systems that are in such states is a problem of experimental physics, yes. The philosophical problem or foundational problem of how to think about our theory I've claimed to kind of get some fuel for my upcoming discussion here, get a good basis for it. I would claim that the philosophical discussion can be launched by imagining that systems are in quantum vector states. And I want to just put on the table the orthodox view that there is a great scarcity of values of physical quantities compared with classical mechanics. Namely, you have to be in an eigenstate in order to have a value. Yeah.
Just to clarify, I would put the other way around. Like, for all practical purposes, exponentially, you can have a system in an eigenstate because you can have, like, you know, you measure it and afterwards you measure it again, and kind of the deviation will be incredibly small. But philosophically, it's the other way around, that because we need to put the whole world, the whole universe at zero temperature in order that you have nothing interacting with your state. And that's kind of not really consistent with anything, putting it like
zero temperature. Oh, sure. Okay. That's a good point. Two comments, well, three actually. One is, the first main one is I'm going to guillotine the discussion in order to get my measurement problem stated, though I think you probably all know it. And the second comment is I'm going to take a question from the young lady over there. But my third comment is just to answer you. My eigenvalue eigenstate link is not a statement that this value that is possessed when it's in an eigenstate should be conserved over time. So I completely agree with you, but I just want to make the comment that it was an instantaneous, it was a proposition about the instantaneous facts. I agree that that things change over time. Okay, sorry, last question.
I'm just going to ask, is that value if your eigenstate is not actually a single eigenstate, but a superposition of the eigenstates in the system?
It must be an eigenstate. I'm saying that, that's why I call it V for value. So a measured system, sorry, a micro system, a quantum system, has got a value V for a quantity Q, if and only if its state is an eigenstate of Q. And if the eigenvalue for that eigenstate is V, then the value of the quantity is indeed V.
But isn't a superposition of eigenstates for the system also an eigenstate of the system?
Well, it is. If you take two eigenstates, which are eigenstates for the same value, yes, then their superposition will be an eigenstate for that value. So this eigenvalue has an eigenspace which is of dimension greater than one. But if you superpose two eigenstates corresponding to different eigenvalues, then that superposition will not be an eigenstate.
Of that operator.
Yes, it will be an eigenstate of something else, but there will then be a value for that something else quantity. But it's not going to have a value for... I'm sorry, I should have stressed that the value denial involved in the eigenvalue-eigenstate link is a value denial for the quantity which I called Q, whose eigenstates we're discussing. Yes. Okay, I've broken my rule. I was going to go into the discussion, but you charmed me into it.
This is a technical question. By eigenvector, do you mean an eigenvector or a generalized eigenvector? Because there are...
I mean, actually, for the entirety of today, eigenvector. Now, you, of course, this is where the different backgrounds come in. Clever clogs who know about generalized eigenvectors or even, you know, rigged Hilbert space, you can probably adapt everything I say to that kind of stuff. But don't feel any impulse to do so unless you love it, right? I mean, everything I'm going to say can be finite dimensional Hilbert space. So the whole discussion is really this, you know? It's all in n-dimensional complex Hilbert space for me. Okay. Now I'm going to obey my rule. Okay. And of course I need to speed up. So there's the measurement problem, right? I've seen that. We'll take it away. So I'm still in part one where I'm trying to give you this overview. So obviously, if you have a momentum measurement of something that's in a superposition of two momentum eigenstates, and you have an apparatus which has a ready state, which I'll call R, and it reliably reads the eigenstates in the sense that it gets into a state where a pointer reads or registers the corresponding momentum eigenvalue, then if you trigger it with an initial superposition, and I've not minded about normalization, imagine that you've forgotten your quantum course telling you that the state is a normalized vector, and there's a superposition of 1 and 2, and you get out by the linearity of the evolution, you don't need to know it's unitary, it's just linearity here, you get this, okay. And the juxtaposition of the two kets is indicating tensor product in the usual way. And I just want to make the remark that that last state, the final right-hand state, is not an eigenstate of pointer position. Okay. And that is enough, according to the eigenvalue eigenstate link, to say that the pointer doesn't have a definite position. So this is Schrodinger's cat without the pain and cruelty. Okay. And no more about the cat, but that's obviously the measurement problem. Okay, and I said that I wanted to give a survey, and looking ahead then, when you see this problem, one important natural objection is to say, surely our problem might be an artifact of only discussing the microsystem and the apparatus. No apparatus is isolated, it has an environment. We should consider the environment. And when we do so, we'll get some state for electron plus pointer plus environment. And we need to really look at the formalism of composite systems carefully. Presumably the state of a big threefold composite like that will determine a state for its components, in particular the pointer. And when we do so, we actually find that we need this formalism of density matrices or mixtures. And indeed, this is what I call the trick or the promise, which was illusory for solving the measurement problem. This mixture looks good. This mixture looks good in the sense that this is perhaps one of the very biggest, perhaps the biggest development in the physics of the measurement problem in the last 25 years has been the revelation, especially by schools in Los Alamos who are represented here this week by Professor Zurek, and schools in Heidelberg, so it's kind of European-North American synergy. The revelation of the fact that for in many models with realistic model Hamiltonians for how the pointer should interact with its environment, the determined state for the pointer is indeed a mixture, and it's a mixture of position eigenstates. And you might say, well, how does that solve the measurement problem? And let me just sketch here that a mixture will be a lot like a classical statistical mechanical probability distribution. So if we were doing classical statistical mechanics and we had a phase space, I'll come over here for a change just for fun. So we have a phase space gamma, say. Obviously, the individual points, which are kind of QP, are pure states in a classical sense, and probability distributions on gamma, or rather on which send events, subsets of gamma, into an element of the 0-1 interval, probabilities, these things are classical mixed states or classical mixtures, and they are normally interpreted as representing good old, straightforward, not a philosophy problem, ignorance about what is the actual pure microstate of the classical system. Of course, you can then do philosophy of probability like we were forced to in our discussion, about subjective chance, but it's not a big issue outside the philosophy of probability. It's an ignorance interpretable probability. Mixtures will be essentially like that. And so if I'm told, well, they will be to a first approximation, that is how we will be thinking of quantum mixtures. And therefore, if I am told that when I look at the threefold state and then look at what it determines for the apparatus, I get a mixture of position eigenstates or something very close, then it looks like yippee. I have got, in my example above, an ignorance interpretable description, which gives some probability to reading one and some probability to reading two. In fact, pretty much 50-50, just as you'd like, according to the Born rule. So it will look like the Born rule has been vindicated, and you have a straightforward situation. However, this mixture is not interpretable in the way I have just sketched. Ignorance interpretable. It is weirder than that. And in that sense, there is still a measurement problem. Okay, so this might be familiar. If it's not familiar, don't worry, we're going to see it in more detail. Would anyone like to nevertheless put a spoke in my wheel? You know, the bicycle is going now. This is the time to stop it. Yeah. So
I don't want to take a long time on this, but simply, what role does decoherence play in that process? And you know, if can you describe that process without decoherence actually happening? I've heard it. I mean, I've heard it both.
Yeah.
Ways.
Yeah. The idea that a threefold composite state determines a state for what each of its components. That's just the maths of the quantum mechanics of composite systems. What's striking is to have this determined state for the apparatus have the expression in terms of position of the pointer eigenstates. And that depends upon the physics of the Hamiltonian of the pointer environment interaction. In this discussion, though I've got it written there, electron plus, it's so tiny it plays no role in the main topic. Our main topic now is not the destiny of the electron. It can, you know, go hang, as they say. What matters in the measurement problem is securing some kind of satisfying account of the apparent definiteness of the macroscopic realm, in particular the point of position. So, the short answer is decoherence, the physics of decoherence, the nature of that pointer environment Hamiltonian is crucial to getting a mixture with these right components.
But you don't really have to do that. I mean, if you just look at the initial superposition line that you have up there, 1 plus 2 on R yields that. If you just trace out the electron, then you have the proper mixture, which is what you want. That doesn't have anything to do with decoherence. You're just ignoring the electron.
That's it. Okay.
So what did I miss?
You miss nothing. And you're right, the slide is very partial. I on later slides, I will say exactly what you said. And then one will worry, oh, well, maybe bring in the environment. And I will say what you said. Then I will say it isn't a solution because the mixture in the pointer defined by that twofold composite state is improper.
What is that? Did you define that yet?
No, not
okay.
Yet. Yeah. But when we see that it's improper and we still feel we have a problem, then we will perhaps turn to the environment.
Right.
Okay. So in a sense, two things are going on this slide. One is I'm saying it's natural to appeal for the environment, and this is a very important development in physics because of our understanding now of what we learn, of what it determines. But it's also true that there's a kind of false move being announced here. The general idea of, as you've put it, tracing out the rest, and the falsity of the move is that we get something mathematically right but not interpretatively right. Okay, so that's the measurement problem, and I'm zooming on. Okay, so we're nearly at the end, you'll be glad to know, of the survey. And in, we're just two more slides until the end of the survey, and you may find that all hell breaks loose in these two slides, because, well, you might actually feel that peace reigns, because when it comes to solving the measurement problem, every different author, quite understandably, will have their own way of, you know, structuring the territory, taxonomizing the positions, classifying the options. Right? So anyway, one way I like to do it is to say there are two binary choices, and they're independent, and so there are four general strategies. Okay. And actually, I'd like to tell you a joke, which is that when I was a student, a famous pure mathematician called John Conway was in the university, and he lectured on analysis. And he did it without notes, and he had a few jokes, and one of them was, you know, when you're doing analysis, you sometimes want to get, so to speak, some long and complex expression at the end of your proof is less than the arbitrarily chosen epsilon, which could be arbitrarily smaller. And in order to organize that in the final line, it's sometimes necessary to choose something very contrived, like delta over 17 in line 3, you know, so that you get less than the arbitrary epsilon at the end. So anyway, he was proving this thing, and he had confessed that since he had no notes, he said to the audience, yes, well, it's either I need to either choose epsilon upon 4 or epsilon upon 8 here, and I'd like to warn you that I suffer from a disease called dilemmatitis, which is that when faced with a binary choice, I make the wrong one. And so anyway, there are two choices here, and if you suffer from dilemmatitis, you'll be following the wrong research program. But I don't know how to advise this, since they're all honorable traditions, actually. Okay, so you can see there, one thing you might do is you could propose new dynamical laws that will evolve a superposition into a proper mixture.
Now, wait a second. This is the second time she's listed proper and improper without defining them.
Yes, that's right. Because I think a very important concept, and all this was meant to be in the kind of preamble survey.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Sorry, I'm getting impatient.
No, that's good on you. Good on you. Extra values would be to ascribe certain quantities values that go beyond those prescribed by the eigenvalue eigenstate link. Because in a second, so our measurement problem was that there was too few values, there were fewer values than we want for a definite macroscopic realm. And then there's a kind of philosophical retrenchment or caution that you can take notice of, and it leads to another binary choice. You can say, hang on, you've said the cat is definitely alive or dead, the pointer is definitely reading 1 or 2, we must have an interpretation of our physics, or a revision of our physics, first option, which secures a definite macroscopic realm. But actually, what do you know? What you really know is that the pointer looks like it's reading 1. In your experience, in your appearances, there's definiteness. So this suggests that you could go with what we have been doing before. We want a definite macroscopic realm. We will get a definite pointer position. And in that sense, we will then connect up with your psychology department or your biophysics department or your, you know, physiological psychology department colleagues in giving what Helmholtz and Maxwell and so on began, sort of ordinary classical psychophysics of perception. It is the definiteness of the position of the pointer, the appropriateness of a classical mechanical description of the pointer as reading 1, that makes an image on your retina lie in one part of your retina rather than another. And there is then a neurological process that can be modeled in with classical chemistry, ball and stick models of molecules, and okay. Then, of course, we have a philosophy discussion over a beer some evening about how this yields experience. We might differ about the physical comprehensibility of consciousness, and we may need a few beers to sort it out. But setting aside the mind-body problem, the idea will be classical psychophysics will take over once I've secured a definite macro realm. On the other hand, you could be a, hey, caution, Mr. Skeptic, right? I all I know is that appearances are definite, in which case you might say, oh, actually, the macroscopic world could be cloudy, nebulous, indefinite, scarce in values, and yet in some way it appears definite. And then there's going to be some quantum weirdness, funny business, perhaps in the mind-matter relationship. Okay, I'm afraid I thought all hell might break loose. At least we have two questions. Would you like to go first?
So, does that mean that you're even saying that there exists such a thing as a objective reality?
Sorry, I think every philosopher would want to say there is an objective reality. But it might not be the common sense reality of tables and chairs in their definite positions. So, the deaf app merchant says, oh, there is an objective reality, but it isn't the objective, it isn't every day. In fact, we'll see in a minute that der Fact is leading to, on this way of taxonomizing, the Everett view, which you may well be familiar with. So there's this sense in which on the Everett view there is an objective reality, but it contains many components, only one of which we see.
So, I think there is a bit uneasy that now the mind is supposed to come in inside for that. A lot of quantum foundation revolves around getting rid of the observer and, as it is called, baby talk of methods.
Yes.
So, but I suppose the mind is really, so that's really clear to bring that in. So, I wanted to solicit some kind of statement of yours whether you think this is really a good idea. To try to connect the macroscopic world to our senses, and rather go for the, you know, one of the obvious choices that in the macroscopic we get deterministic laws, and in the best way we would only have to speak about ignorance probably.
Yeah.
So, yeah. What's your opinion on this?
Okay, that's a very good question. My opinion is that quantum theory is probably false.
Or,
we won't know that for maybe centuries, even with all possible funding. Because, you know, obviously what we learned is subject to funding and good fortune and, you know, not too bad global warming. But assuming all goes well in empirical inquiry,
yeah.
I suspect that if not in 50 years, in 100 or 1,000, quantum theory will fail.
And do you even think that it is wrong in the microscopic realm, or that there might be some sort of transition when we're going to larger and larger systems than, say, the universe,
yeah.
Then really different deterministic laws govern the whole thing?
No, I think it would be a case of it being fundamentally wrong in ways that show up mostly in large systems, thus giving us some kind of solution to the measurement problem. That's my long-term ultimate background belief, right? That it remains a question, so what should I now believe? And other than this kind of search me, our theory is probably wrong. And of course, it's not so much what should I believe, but how should I spend my time as a philosopher of physics or as a foundation physics person. And of course, for a philosopher, you can say, well, look, interpreting a theory that is our best is a good intellectual endeavor, even if your background belief is that it's probably ultimately wrong. And so I can then choose among these options, and I do actually think that of the four options I'm about to show you in the next slide, three are very honorable. One of them is Everett, actually. And in that sense, it's going to be a deaf app. It's going to... it'll be less mindy than this final three lines might suggest. Because the Everett view can be developed, of course, in many different ways. There are some people who call themselves many minds Everettians. I don't endorse that kind of Everett. I prefer the many worlds kind of Everett. But so this is my view. In fact, since we're coming up to coffee time, I may as well tell you everything you need to know about me, which is, like I've said, my long-term view is it's false. I'd also just like to say that I like this Carlo Rovelli analogy of where we are in physics at the beginning of the 21st century. Namely, we are, as Dante says, I believe, in the opening lines of the whatever it is called. we are halfway through the woods.
Right.
We are rather like Galileo. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So we are halfway through the woods, rather like, as it might be, Galileo, halfway between Copernicus and Newton. The quantum and relativity revolutions set in a period of ferment. Those two frameworks have both been extraordinarily successful in regimes of, you know, distance or energy and so on, far beyond those for which they were originally designed. General relativity, so to speak, designed for solar system tests, confirmed in the binary pulsar in gravitational fields 10,000 times stronger than the solar system to about 8 or 10 decimal places. Quantum mechanics designed for the atomic scale, valid apparently at the quark scale, and indeed superfluidity, superconductivity at much larger distance scales. So that we are actually, at the end of the 20th century, sort of victims of our own success in physics, because it's very hard to get data to push these theories, i.e. to probe them and show them wrong. And of course, there have been various suggestions from time to time that sort of new physics was required, for example, for pulsars, I believe. But quantum and JR have, you know, systematically mocked up what came along in the data. So we're stuck. And we're halfway through the woods. But I suspect that in some way, when it all is revealed by the kind of analog of Newton in 100 or 1,000 years, there'll be some give by quantum as well as by GR. Okay, and then you. Yeah.
I was just going to ask clarification on the definition. When you say a definite macro realm, do you mean that a reality that only has sort of is only one possible way, and we don't see it exactly the way it is because some psychological effect comes in? And then when you say indefinite macro realm, do you mean a reality that can be in many different ways with certain probabilities, and we only see one of those ways because of certain things?
Yes, but it's not that. I agree with almost all of that. The one thing I disagree with is, you said indefinite macro realm means macro realm can be one of many ways with various probabilities and we only see one. Indefinite macro realm is a bit more radical. It is all of those various ways in a certain sense, and we only see one. So the indefiniteness is true blurriness. It's not like the horse race, where one thing happens, but there were various possibilities. It's that they're all actual.
So that's okay. That's def
act. That's def act, yes. Indefiniteness of the macro realm, only the appearances are definite. We only see one branch.
Right.
Okay, so.
So I'm an expert in on the subject, and so in light of those strategies, so I just never worked on saying, so what's, in your definition of the measurement problem, what's the actual problem? Is it that the fact that once you get the environment to account, you get the appropriate mixture? Or is the problem, I mean, I don't know what I'm watching, but so where's the problem in all of that? So what actually your problem?
Thank you. I didn't actually write on the slide what the problem was. I just said, The final state is not an eigenstate of pointed position, exclamation mark. And the exclamation mark was like a warning that this is not good enough. So what is the problem? The problem is to rethink the physics we have, or to revise the physics, to make it true that the macroscopic pointer is in a definite position, according to our theory.
But why? I mean,
So we have, say, in the example, an electron one to measure momentum. It goes in the momentum eigenstate, or well, yeah. And you get that it's not in a position eigenstate. But that's not, I mean, we cannot expect that, no? It's not expected.
Sorry, when you consider the measurement of the electron in the initial superposition,
yeah.
You say you're triggering the apparatus with an initial superposition.
Mm-hmm.
You're absolutely right. I think you're pressing me on the question, at the end of such a thing, what should physics describe the pointer as being? Well, according to the Born rule, since I had equal weights for 1 and 2, there's some sense in which physics shouldn't choose the one, and it shouldn't choose the two. It should deliver me a description of the pointer as being either in one, either reading one or reading two, and doing so with 50-50 probabilities. And I want my physics to, in that sense, deliver an ignorance-interpretable mixture as a description of the pointer, right? And I'm sorry, I should have perhaps written that on the slide, yes. That's what I would intuitively want the physics to provide. And as that gentleman was pointing out, it is mathematically provided by the formalism of density matrices and the way that a state for a composite system determines states for its components. But I will be objecting that this isn't yet home and dry. We're not yet finished, because the mixture thus derived to describe the pointer is improper. So I hope that's all right. Yeah. Okay, one last question. Sorry to cut you off, yeah.
I think you mentioned already where when you choose this choice, this proposal of interpretation is the
reference. Yeah, the relational. Frankly, I don't know. That's a good question. Somebody will tell us over coffee. Lucian, we should keep the schedule.
Okay.